Welcome back to the Weekly Manga Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about all of your favorite ongoing Japanese manga. This week, we're going to cover Akane Banashi Chapter 130, which ends in a huge twist. We're also going to cover, if I had a nickel for every series based in 1920s America that launched on Manga Plus this year, I'd have two nickels, which is a little weird. That's happened twice. So let's talk about that new series called Nightlight Hounds. And finally, a new adult romance, which does not take place in a schoolyard. That's wild, I know, but it's true. That's Monochrome Days, another new series. All that manga news and more coming right up. Hello again, my name is Bruce. I am the proprietor of the White Gray Black YouTube channel. This week I am joined again by my constant co-host Gautam.
What's up?
A special shout out and thanks to our Patreon subscribers, Yaji Black. If you want to have your name read at the top of the episode, see some bonus content, check out patreon.com/WGB manga. It is only $3. And I wanted to give a quick shout out that we are almost at a point where we can start making a little bit of spare change on this YouTube channel. You guys have watched a lot of our videos. You have a lot of hours watched these past 6 months or so. We really appreciate that. We just need a couple more subscribers. So if you enjoy this content, if you like the book clubs we do or the weekly manga podcast, please click that subscribe button on YouTube and get us there. Thanks a lot. Let's talk about Akane Banashi, Chapter 130. This is a big one, Gautam. It's all a mess.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we're
bleak chapter.
Yeah, a bleak, interesting. I don't know. I think this is the best series to jump right now. Like this is. I love the series.
It's real good.
This is post. Post their sensei's heart attack, which we had, I think, last week, I guess, a week ago. He was recovering in the hospital. He lived. He did not die. I kind of expected that, I guess. We have Akane and the other people kind of helping take care of him in the hospital, because Akane is obviously the person who found him. They go back to his place to get him some clothes and some other stuff. They find a picture. This is a picture of... Oh gosh, I'm gonna remember the names. It's him and the guy who's at the end of the chapter, and it's like these are the three masters. We've met all these guys before. So
yeah.
But yeah, so they're kind of get sentimental. There's some good humor in it, which I think is always great. Akane's always really funny. They're kind of broken up because this guy is like, he's like their boss and their dad and their leader and tells them exactly what to do and teaches them stories. And yeah, this is he had a heart attack, and it revealed that he has throat cancer, which means he might lose his voice. So kind of a bad, this is a bad chapter. This is, there's some dark stuff in here.
And I think this is like an interesting one to follow up the play we saw, right?
Yeah. He had his big moment with, telling the death story,
the
Shinigami. Yeah.
Shinigami and death and curing people, and and that was his last hurrah on stage, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a reflection of the story that he told, but also I think this is like, I think he'll live, but I think his time on stage is done, right?
I think so, yeah. I think for sure. And it is an interesting comparison, because for sure I think what we saw, because that was the first time we saw him do a full performance on stage for like a large group of people, was doing that story. I think is called Shinigami, which is like Death God.
Yeah,
so we saw him do that. That was it, like blew the doors off of everybody, like he always does. It showed how much of a rock star he still is, even in his kind of old age. And then the other kind of important thing that we saw before that is that he teaches Akane the, like, I don't remember what it's called exactly, like secret story, right, that his master tried to teach him that nobody else can like do as well, or like has even attempted to really try to do what their old master could do. He taught that to Akane, right? Which is very clearly kind of like a seed planted, which she will bloom into, I guess I will say. Like, she's going to tell that story, I would guess, at the very climax of this entire story. Like, that is her final performance, or the big climax of the story is probably her telling the story that her sensei taught to her, that kind of secret story. She'll become good enough and understand it well enough to be able to recreate it. And all the old Shigemo masters will see it and they'll be like, yep, she did it. She's the one. Like, she's the chosen one. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that is the way we'll probably go. I think he might die, actually. Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah. I think it's possible.
Because, like, if you think about the story, right, is about a doctor kind of making a deal with a Shinigami, but also curing people, and doing a workaround to kind of bypass the Shinigami's restrictions, right? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the doctor gets pulled into a cave and dies, presumably there. Because no one can escape death.
Yeah, true.
And I suppose he's passing on his legacy to all of his disciples in multiple ways. If this is a reflection of the story and the one time we saw him on the stage, then I think it would make sense if he died.
I could see it going either way. I think it's almost more affecting and sad if they treat his throat cancer and he can't talk anymore, but he's still around to sort of like watch Akane rise. Like, that's sad that like this dude who is like, you know, one of the top, what, three Rakugo masters in Tokyo can't do Rakugo anymore. And as we see kind of at the end of the chapter, all of his pupils are kind of spread to the winds. I think that him kind of watching that happen and then still seeing Akane and his other pupils kind of rise to the challenge, I think that would be satisfying for him. But it is one of those things where, yeah, that Shinigami story he told is very much about you cannot escape death. It does not matter what you do. It comes for everybody. So,
right. And, you know, I could see it because I think it would be like a happier thing if he lived and saw Akane's growth.
Mm-hmm.
But I could also kind of see him dying and having Akane and the rest of the crew under him being, because every other Rakugo master is somewhat hostile. And
yeah,
especially towards Akane and the team, right? Because they're outliers in regards to convention. So it would be interesting to see kind of Akane versus the world kind of a situation. Despite being backed against a corner, she kind of makes her way up with skill alone.
Yeah, which is kind of, yeah, what we've been watching, I think, the whole time. So,
yeah, but losing her kind of pillar of support here.
Yeah, they definitely, these people have definitely lost their sort of like home.
Yeah.
But I mean, continuing on, you know, we have obvious tears. I believe in master and hold our heads high and support him. That's what an apprentice does. Like, we can't turn our back on him. You know, he's hurt. We can't give up. And she, Akane comes back and sees, this is the, I can't remember which Shigemo.
It's the main guy. Too many manga men.
Yeah, it's okay. Shigemo Arakawa is
Arakawa. Yeah.
No, that's the heart attack guy. The Arch Four. Okay, wait. Arakawa School. I have to find this because, like, I cannot remember their names. No, that's Shigemo Arakawa. Isho. That's his name. Isho. So this is Isho Arakawa, right? They're all Arakawa School. Arakawa was the master who told the secret story. He's in here watching. Everything that's been shown of this guy is he's presented to us as kind of the main adversary. If you were to say who is the bad guy in Akane, it is probably Isho Arakawa, I would say.
He's the antagonist, yeah.
He is the antagonist. I think what he does here basically is that he's like, I've spoken with the other, you know, the other leaders, and he's dismantling the Shigemo school. He's basically saying, your master's out of it. All of his underlings are going somewhere else.
And he said it in a way, meaner way.
He's an asshole. Like,
there isn't anything else you can learn. You can learn from this wreck of a man. Right there.
Yeah.
And he's just a huge prick about it. But you kind of know him. Over the course of the series, he is sad about it.
Oh yeah,
and he also cares a ton about Rakugo.
Yep.
He is still a huge prick, of course. But.
Yeah, his communication skills exceptionally low for someone who is a storyteller. He's like, the four apprentices will be sent to different guardians. And Akane, like, she gets mad here. She's like, dismantling the school guardians. Like, you said you could decide all that. She's like, my master is Shikamaru Arakawa. You don't have any right to tell me what to do. He's like, it's already decided. And your guardian, Akane Arakawa, is me. You'll be under the care of Isho Arakawa. Here's how I think this goes and how I'm reading this. I think what you said is right. I think Isho Arakawa's main focus is good Rakugo. Like, above everything else, there is good Rakugo in a way that he wants to see it, which I think we're kind of, we want to be told that he wants like an old conservative style of Rakugo. I actually don't think that's true.
That's not true. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think that's true at all. This whole end of this chapter reads to me like Isho Arakawa sees the potential in Akane, and he's breaking up the school because they need to keep learning, and his pupils are all really good, and he's taking Akane because he knows that she's the best. Like, that is what I see this as. Like,
or maybe not even the best, just the most potential.
The most potential, He can teach her things, and she will get better. Because,
I think to your point, he doesn't care about traditionalism, though that is his style. He cares more about the art being popular, I guess, and its perception in the public eye.
And preserved in a way that, not like preserved in a frozen in time style, but preserved in people are still doing new things and keeping it popular and all that stuff. So, which I think is evident from like chapter one, right, where Akane's dad fails, and we learn kind of throughout the story that he didn't fail because he was trying a new stuff. He failed because he like tried a hard story and wasn't good enough. And it's like, Isho was just like, I see you, you're not good enough. And get out, you know, like I kick you out or whatever. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is like a interesting point. I want to see how Akane does under his teachings.
Yeah.
And what his teaching style even is, you know?
I think this is going to be super cool. Like, I'm hyped for what happens next, because I think whatever story she learns from Isho and performance she gives kind of with him watching, I think that will be incredibly interesting to see, because it's one of those things that you like other shonen series can't do this because the bad guy has to be defeated. But in Akane, in this series, they're all just like human beings, and there's no one to be defeated. There's no one to be overcome. The competition is, you know, between people, and multiple people can succeed. And so like, there's no defeating Isho Arakawa, right? Like there's no, I proved you wrong.
They all want
and you're
thing.
Taken down. Like that's not going to happen in this series. What's going to happen is that Rakugo is going to succeed in a way that Isho Arakawa is going to help Akane become better. And I think she's going to resist that. I think it's going to be fun to watch her push back against Isho at first, and then maybe either see him perform, or he'll give her some advice where she's like, wait, that's really smart. Or like, oh, that's the same thing my old master told me. He's trying to teach me. Like, I don't know. I think there's a lot of cool, fun potential in this whatever's upcoming here.
So I'm curious as to how he will teach her, because Akane is a free spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody who has taught her has never taught her with a heavy hand. It has always been by guiding her towards the answer in the approximate direction, and she gets there herself.
It's like
teaching a kid just to like stare forward and pedal instead of explaining the functions of the bike itself, right?
Yeah,
it's like you kind of, everyone has guided Akane to water and not taught her how to drink. So I don't know if she'll like handle a style where she's like, you have to do it this way and this way and this way
So I think, tell me if you have picked up on this or read what I'm reading into this. I think what we have seen with the last couple of Akane performances is that I think she has a weakness in performance. I think she sort of discovered her like mental palace. You know, I can combine all these worlds of Rakugo that live in the same place, and it's this living world, and I can step into it and explore it and embody all of it. I think every time that she's done that, which I think maybe is just two performances, maybe three, I think that she has a tendency to get lost and to sort of like not have a focus or a guiding light when that happens. Like, I think one of the times she did it, she like overwent her time, or like almost overran her time. She was being timed or whatever. Right. So I think that what Isho is going to do is going to give her more of, more of sort of like structure. Guiding rails structure, so that she knows, like, I can go into that world, and I can bring these little, you know, the other funny characters in, and everyone appreciates that, but I can't get lost in there. I need to be focused on the story. So that my prediction is that he fixes what I see as her one, not like a glaring issue, but like, I think she has a shortcoming in that she discovered this world. And I think she gets lost in there. And I think if she were focused when she goes into that world, her storytelling would be better. And I think that's what Isho is going to foster in her.
I could definitely see that. I think that would be a good route to take. She is a structure rebel after all.
Yeah. She's very rebellious. And I think, I think, The point of Isho maybe here is going to be like, you can be rebellious, but at a certain point, like, the masters know what they're talking about. The old, you know, the old masters are good for a reason. And she knows that old story. So I wonder if, I don't know. That old story is going to play into it somehow. And I'm super curious. That's a big MacGuffin. So,
yeah. Well, we'll see how it plays out.
Cool. Yeah. Anything else on Akane here?
No. Great chapter, though.
Yeah, really good. I really like this series. Let's talk about a new series. This is Night Lighthounds Chapter 1. This is by Haruhisa Nakata. This guy has a fully published series from about 10 years ago that was pretty popular, whose name I did not write down, but you can look up that author's name. This is the 1920s America series I mentioned, this along with Drunk Bullet. For some reason, there are two of these series that take place kind of in the Roaring 20s area. During 20s timeline. This is an interesting little vampire werewolf something series, I guess I would say.
I'd say that. Vampire werewolf gangster story.
Yeah. I gotta say, the first half of this chapter one didn't really impress me. It was not necessarily, it was like partially generic and partially just boring in my opinion. So we'll just kind of go through it really quick. We have Jimmy, our main character here, who's the most anime-looking person out of all the other American guys here. He's kind of in with the mob, like at a very low level. His boss up here on the left, I don't even remember his name. It doesn't really matter. He's kind of...
Yeah, Jimmy's a henchman. Yeah.
Just to clarify. Jimmy is, or the...
Yeah, Jimmy's just a mob henchman.
Yeah, just, yeah, low-level mob henchman guy, yeah. His boss is this kind of dark-haired guy. It is still interesting, I will say. I mentioned this when we talk about Drunk Bullet, you know, months ago, whatever. It's still cool to see, like, oh, it's old America as opposed to a Japanese setting. I still appreciate that. I still think that's cool.
Did they, like, coordinate to, like, because I never see the setting, and seeing it twice, no. Like you said in the intro, is, like, wild. But, I don't know. It is cool to see again, though.
It could be the allure of, like, I'm going to write a story that takes place 100 years ago, because this, like, very well could be 1924. So, I don't know. But yeah, so yeah, he's an asshole. He's like, oh, I'll give you your cut. And he punches him in the face. Like, it's very like Jimmy's in a rough and tumble place and he's down on his luck and nothing. Yeah, this is Silent Bay City. You're here for good. Shut up and play by the rules. It's very kind of generic. They talk a lot about, like, the rich people getting rich and the poor getting poorer, which is, you know, kind of a Great Depression.
A universal truth. Yeah.
A universal truth, but was worse in the Great Depression before, oh gosh, what was the Roosevelt thing? The New Deal. New Deal fixed a lot of that stuff, but we got rid of the New Deal over the past 100 years, so. But, Jimmy's like, I don't have anyone to protect. My problem maybe with chapter one is that Jimmy is an anime protagonist in the middle of, like, a dark, serious adult fantasy story. And it's like, okay, dude, like, I don't have anyone to protect.
I see what you're saying. And I wish we, like, saw maybe a flashback of him and his brother, because
you only really get one little flashback. Yeah. That's barely, it just, like, shows his brother's hand, right? But yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, yeah. Here, Jimmy's friend is like,
he's like, I'm leaving. Yeah. I'm getting out of here.
They put me on a job for, like, a high member of the opposing gang, and I'm just going to leave. It's too dangerous of a job, and I'm sick of working.
I'm going to take my wife and kids and get out of there. So Jimmy goes up and contemplates life and death on top of his New York City apartment building. He's basically just, like, about to jump, in my opinion. And it's like, this baseball comes over. It's like, oh, the ball that he kind of threw away. He's like, oh, weird. He throws it away and it gets thrown back to him. Oh, wow. Weird. He's like,
I love this part.
This is a good part. Yeah. I think all the stuff on the roof with Lily here is really good. So he writes, who are you on the ball, and throws it. And he goes, oops, it fell off. He's like, oh, well, no one's here. And he's like, oh no, someone's behind me. He falls and this little girl catches him. Again, anime character inserted into a serious thing, but it's cool. She's like,
you know what? I'm cool with it because I think Lily is very cute.
Yeah. And I think she, yeah, I this was the cutest part to me where he throws the ball and she like chases it like a dog, which is foreshadowing.
Yeah.
And like pulls him up like that way. Cause she's really strong. But yeah, she's really cute and even says she's like a little puppy.
I did not put together this was vampire and werewolf stuff at this point.
It's what it's going for, for sure.
Yeah.
But she kind of comes back the next night and they kind of talk and, you know, she's like, what's that? She's very curious, little kid. Here's like the very brief flashback we get. It's like one day after work, my brother wasn't home. Some gang blew up a shop in the city and his brother got blown up with his... My brother's hand was a corned beef sandwich from that shop. This is the weirdest, maybe the strangest flashback of like my brother died I've ever seen. It's just like a corned beef sandwich.
He mentions the corned beef
sandwich. It's a very New York thing, to be honest. Like that's a very like Jewish deli New York thing. So it's like, I get it. Like someone did the research. So I'll give him that. But
yeah. Yeah. It's specific. So it's like a little fun.
It is. But yeah, he's like, I promised my brother I'd take him out. We get a little bit of sort of like, Jimmy gets his, I didn't have anybody to protect and that's what I needed. And here's this girl who he feels like he can protect. So he names her Lily.
She's very happy. Essentially, he's suicidal, but he's looking for purpose, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And there's like I think it was before this, but Lily and him were looking at this like skyscraper and she asked what it is. Yeah. And he's like, oh, that's where the stock exchange is, you know, like where all the rich people make their money. And Lily growls and she's like, vampires.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, vampires are there. They're going to eat you if you get too close.
Yeah, they suck up all the money. Money vampires. Yeah. I do wonder how much social commentary this will be about the rich and the poor. Because there's a little bit of it. They kind of stated in this chapter one, but then the end of the chapter isn't really about that, so I wonder how much of the series is actually going to be about that.
I mean, there's like a lot they could do with already set up the blocks, right? It's like, and I think it's all but implied that like they are saying like the wealthy are just blood-sucking vampires.
Yeah, the wealthy and the mobsters and people who take advantage of other people. Yeah, for sure. He names her Lily. She's very cute. She kind of runs off down the street and runs to this man. And Jimmy's like, you were dad. It's like, what are you doing leaving her out alone so late? I really like this thing at this point. The guy who's kind of implied to be her caretaker or whatever says like, you're disappointed that she's not worse off than you. I think it's cause it's like, you don't want to admit that you felt this, but like I've felt this before where it's like, you know, I'm kind of down on my luck, but I see somebody who's like, oh, they're really down. Let me help them out. And then I understand the feeling of like, oh, wait, they aren't that down their luck. That kind of makes me mad. Like, I thought that they were really down. I was helping them and now they're fine. Like, that's I get that. Like, that's I relate to that.
Yeah. So. And I appreciate it because it's like the main character just needs a sense of purpose to feel useful, given his backstory, especially. But yeah. Like, he just needs to feel wanted and useful and in some way. And he's calling it out. You're disappointed she's not worse off than you. She's not like a project for him, right?
You don't have to take care of her. She has someone taking care of her. Sorry. Yeah. So he gets mad, storms off, and drives off to do this kind of like job thing. This is a warehouse where the mobsters have dump all their bodies, basically. So he goes in, he sees a dark, monstrous figure, scary. He ends up going to the police and being like, look, there's a monster killing people. I'll tell you exactly where it is. Throw all the mobs. He basically like rats. He like says everything. And they're like, okay, wait here. And they go and they get his boss. And he's like, hey,
the police were on the take.
Yep. Everybody's corrupt. 1920s mobster, New York, or New Bay, what city, whatever it's called.
Jimmy, you're kind of a dumbass. What was this? Like, why did you go to the police? It's like the worst thing you could do.
It like makes sense in the story, but also like, yeah, and if this kid grew up being a mobster, he would not go to the police. So yeah, but
like that's like the biggest faux pas. They'll kill you, man.
Yeah, for sure. So he's like, hey, Jimmy. He takes him back to the place. He's like, you really are stupid. You know why the family are called the rules of the city. Use that little brain. We bought all the cops, and he reveals that basically He's a crazy monster vampire. He was the guy who was eating everybody.
I like this panel. I thought the vampire grew a mustache on first glance.
Oh yeah, it looks like
just shading. Yeah,
that does look like the 20s mustache that was very popular. It does. Pencil stash. Yeah.
This is what all vampires do. Yeah.
They look like Charlie Chaplin. but yeah, the guy who left earlier to like save his family, he's strung up and dead here. So yeah, Jimmy ends up sort of like shooting him, which clearly doesn't do anything, and runs away. This is where I thought that starting from like when we see the fantasy stuff or meeting Lily, even the chapter just gets a lot better.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think this is just a solid first chapter.
Yeah, it's a good first chapter. And I like where it left stuff because it kind of got rid of the boring stuff at the beginning and moved on to more interesting things. So
yeah,
I really like this part where he gets in his little Model T and then the vampire like absolutely destroys it by jumping on it. He like slams into a tree, jumps out.
He's very, just chilling on it. Yeah.
Yeah, very casually, just kind of chilling, showing his power. Yeah, he's like, even with you gone, everything will be fine. Has some kind of weird body changing thing. Not normal vampire powers, by the way.
Yeah.
Which I guess we'll see.
He makes like a blood blade.
Oh, I guess maybe that's what that is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that he was just like changing his body into something, but yeah, I don't know. I was like, that's not normal vampire power. But we're also about to see that the werewolves are not normal either. So.
It's probably like blood jutsu, but I don't know for sure. Yeah.
We get this sort of like, why do I feel like I don't want to die? I wanted to die just a couple days ago. Oh, that's right. I met Lily and she was helping me because I met her and thought living might not be so bad. But he's like, it's fine. I'm finally free. Like, get me out of this shitty world. And then it's like, huh? He sees something. What is it? It's another. This is a great panel. I love this.
It's so cool.
Favorite page of the chapter for sure. Like this, because I knew that she was going to be some kind of werewolf because it kind of tells you at the beginning. But you're like, okay, but what does a werewolf look like? And it's like, oh, that's sick. Like that looks really cool. And like against the full moon is also like very very neat. But yeah, so it's great. The werewolf like absolutely just like annihilates him. Like looks at him, he disintegrates and like. Then she eats him like in some very very cool artistic panels. I think.
Yeah, no, that looks cool. I think she disintegrates him like the vampire's disintegrating from the eyes.
Yeah, something prior about to eating. Her eyes. Yeah,
like sun eyes or something. I don't know.
Oh, maybe I didn't think about that. But the moon is a reflection of the light of the sun, so vampires shouldn't be able to go out in the moonlight.
Is that an actually
take about vampire lore, I guess I would say. So maybe it's
is that,
that
real?
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks though. Being a vampire sucks. Yeah. That's the case.
Yes.
Can't go out either time.
Yeah, so she gulps him down and we have the kind of caretaker guys here. She drops the ball and kind of looks at Jimmy and is like, who are you? Yeah, we can see the kind of
the moon.
The moon reflected. You know, hunters of shadows, the night hounds, we will meet again. And we see that the ball is the who are you ball that he had to Lily. Because obviously the wolf is Lily. Like that's.
Yeah.
That's like, I you figure that out. It's pretty.
And she wrote on the ball, I am Lily.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot there's one more page. Yeah, there we go. I thought that was the end. But yeah, I am Lily. This is how in Silent Bay City, a good friend of the guy like me got all caught up in a conflict between monsters.
And it's kind of cute. The ball got thrown up there in the first place because she was trying to play fetch. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was a great chapter. I think my only thing I didn't love too much was Jimmy himself.
Yeah, same.
And I think that's a problem that hopefully the author tackles in the future.
I think, I think he's already he changed over chapter one, which I can at least appreciate that he, you know, has more information about the world, opens up, he doesn't want to die, he wants to live, so there's at least some of that.
I wish he wasn't so nice. I think that's
he's very much anime protagonist. Like, he's just who he is.
Right?
Like, or just, more interesting in some way. Like, give him some other personality other than, I'm the nicest guy and I'll do anything, I don't want to shoot people. Like, come on.
You know, I think it would be perfect if he was more of like a Yusuke or a Meshi or like a Kuwabara from Yu Yu Hakusho, where he's just like a thug, but he has a heart of gold kind of a thing. Like,
yeah, for sure. If he was like a little bit coarser.
Coarser, more of a dick on first glance.
For sure.
But he's just a very sweet, nice guy who does not suit the sign of work at all.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, like, does he get turned into a werewolf and then he has to fight as a werewolf? Or maybe he says he gets caught in the middle, so I think he probably doesn't turn, but who knows?
I think it'll be that he is Lily's partner going forward, based on, like, how he mentions, like, yeah, I'll be your bodyguard and we can leave, you know? I think it'll be closer to that.
Yeah.
But they stay instead, you know?
I'd also be okay if he's just kind of the point of view character, and the kind of events that happen around him are more of the focus of the story, like what are the vampires and the werewolves or the hounds, whatever they're called. Like, if he's just kind of like he says here, like, caught up in a conflict between monsters, if he's just the point of view character, I think that's okay too. I think it's okay for your point of view character to be kind of a blank slate when you're watching other interesting characters do stuff. So, and this is just setting up, you know, it set up a lot of stuff. So who knows? I'm curious about chapter two, where chapter 2-3 goes here, because I think it could be really interesting.
I thought that was a strong start. So let's see.
Yeah. I'm going to take this time to plug what I think is one of the greatest vampire story of all time. There is a comic series by Scott Snyder, who is mostly famous for writing Batman for years and years. He did the Court of Owls and all that stuff. He wrote a series called American Vampire that is one of the coolest comic series I've ever read. The premise of it basically is that vampires are from Europe, and the vampires in Europe they sort of obey the rules of European vampires. Like, in order to cross on a boat, they have to be standing on the dirt of their own home country. They can't go out during the day or they burn, like all of this stuff. And what happens is this woman gets turned into a vampire in America, and she becomes like a new kind of vampire who can like go out during the day and does not have all the limits and rules that the European vampires have. And it kind of starts this cool contest between like new American vampires and the old European vampires. Cause
that sounds fun.
Yeah, she creates, she like, but only, she kind of like, it's a very like long series. So she does a lot of stuff. She gets bitten, I think, in like 1800s, like early 1800s maybe or something, and she like ends up biting one guy who gets turned, and he kind of becomes the main character later. They kind of both are, but yeah, it's a really, really cool series. It's called American Vampire. There's a lot of cool like Native American. It's Scott Snyder is one of my favorite comic authors because he writes Americana, which is not a thing that a lot of people write anymore, but all of his series that aren't Batman, and even his Batman, I think, is based, has a lot of feelings of it. All of his stuff is about like America and like what it means to be American and the country of America. And it is like Americana, which is very cool. It like has that feeling of like, this couldn't take place anywhere but America. And American Vampire is definitely one of those series. It's very cool. And to catch up with it, cause I'm at this point, like 8 years behind on it, but it's a very, very cool series. So this reminded me of that a lot. So,
I'll plug my favorite werewolf series.
Oh, yeah.
The Wolf Among Us, Telltale Games, based on a comic called Fables that I haven't read. So don't tell me if that one's bad. Play The Wolf Among Us.
Did you see the movie they made? I don't know if it's called A Wolf Among Us, but it's based on A Wolf Among Us. It's like the bunch of people locked in a snowstorm and there's a werewolf, right?
Like, oh, that's based on like the game Werewolf, actually. I saw that movie.
Okay, yeah. That's a fun movie. I remember saying that.
It's
a
pretty fun one, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Let's talk about our last thing here. This is a series called Monochrome Days by Yosuke Matsumoto. This is a new Jump Plus series. This is on Manga Plus over here in the West. This is an adult office romance about two people creating manga. I thought this was pretty cute. I think we both appreciate that this is not a high school romance, which after 70 or so, you get pretty tired of. I also thought that this was a nice story about kind of rediscovering art that you loved as a child that you had to give up to get a job, which I personally relate to a lot. So,
I think there's a lot of relatable qualities in this series. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. I thought it was cute. Basically, we have our two main characters. We have our make no mistakes, be efficient, I'm the perfect office worker, cog in the machine businessman. He is called Fudo-kun. It's like another backbreaking day. He works very hard. He's very much the typical Japanese, the idea of the Japanese businessman of he does his work, he does his things, he stays late. Hanaichi Fudo, yep. He finishes the work, his coworker's work, he works very hard, he works too hard. And then we have this girl here who is the top sales performer, Saori Wakaba. She's very cute. She's very outgoing. She's a great salesperson. She kind of notices that Fudo has some kind of sketching drawing stuff on his desk. Little backstory is basically he used to love to draw manga. He thought he could earn a living through it. His mother died. He had to take care of everybody. He kind of threw it away and said, okay, I have to get a job that gives me money. I can't just draw. As the option the boy chose was far too mature for a 15-year-old. He gave up drawing and he did the thing. So a sad but realistic, I would say, origin story. I think there's a lot of people, I don't know about you, I relate to this because when I was his age and in high school and stuff, I was in theater, I was in bands, I sang in the church choir, I did all these artistic things. And I graduated high school in 2008 when the economy took a turn for the worse. And so I spent all of college basically thinking about what can I do to get a solid job. And basically from 2007, 2008 on, I was not really thinking about what I actually liked or wanted to do. I thought about how I was going to make money and how I could just get a normal job and do that. I don't want to be that ruined my life. But if I could go back, I would go back and stay, I would be this guy and I would go back and stay drawing, right? I would stay invested in the arts and stuff because that brings me more joy than doing the office work that I do now, because that's what I'm stuck doing because I didn't pursue the stuff. So,
well, I'll say this, right? I think this is pretty universally relatable in that.
I think so. I think for our age range especially, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think anyone is growing up thinking, oh, I want to be a marketing director at a Fortune 500 company.
Yeah.
It just kind of happens that way because they want money. And same here, that's why I do my current job.
Yeah.
It's not a passion, Yeah. I didn't think about it at all when I was a kid. I want to be a paleontologist, but
there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is a universally relatable thing where,
for sure,
where they just got into adulthood. They needed the money and they compromised what their childhood goals were. And understandably so, to make said money. And it's now they're kind of regretting it, or they want to pursue that passion as a hobby. And I think that's great. That's cool. It's a good setup that's relatable to a lot of people.
Yeah, I felt very, even though this was a kind of an uneven, it was just an okay chapter one, I really related to that. So I think that made me like it a little bit more. He finds his female coworker here kind of passed out on the floor, and she kind of basically goes into hey, I was trying to ink this stuff. He basically says, you draw manga as a hobby. You were sleep deprived from the looming deadline. So when you saw how poorly the manuscript was printed, you collapsed from shock. And she's like, that's right. He's like, please keep it a secret. No one can know I draw manga. I got made fun of it when I was little. That's what I found out. I still haven't been able to get over being made fun of. This is another thing that I think is pretty relatable, that you have some artistic or niche interest in. When you're a child, you get made fun of that. And then so you stop doing it. And when you look back, you generally think, I shouldn't have stopped doing that. That made me happy.
For me, it was I obstinately did it to spite people,
mm-hmm.
Because I got told once I shouldn't. I leaned in the other way.
Yeah.
For better or worse, harder,
I was definitely, especially middles, 10, 11, 12, middle school ages, I guess, I was a really sensitive kid. And so if I got made fun of, I was crying. If not outside, then I'm serious. If somebody I remember in PE, some just random guy who had no value to me, was not my friend, came up and made fun of me and my friend for playing Yu-Gi-Oh! And I don't think I ever played Yu-Gi-Oh! Again after that day. I just didn't.
That's fucked up.
Because it just emotionally hurt me so bad that someone would go and make fun of me for something I liked. I was a very, very sensitive child. So stuff like that affected me a lot. So anyways, I relate to this. Maybe I'd still be playing Yu-Gi-Oh! If I wasn't so sensitive and nobody made fun of me, but who knows?
Dude, maybe that was your passion.
I sure hope not. of all the things I gave up as a child, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is not one that I miss very much. So, so they kind of connect. She says, Fudo-kun, you draw. I see you drawing during lunch. He's like, what do you say? Help me out. And they kind of go out. She's funny because she's a complete girl failure. And then she goes outside in the public and she's like, haha, I'm composed again. Which I think is really funny. And then she just kind of collapses again. So she's really cute. I think that's great. Gives out kind of the contact info. She kind of notices Fudo-kun likes to draw, and she thinks it's really interesting. Yeah, and she kind of like taught herself to draw.
She mentions like, I thought it was just like an interesting art perspective or insight, is like how hard it is to draw a reflection on metal. I didn't consider that. I'm not an art critic or an art head to that degree to know that it's incredibly hard to draw reflections on metal, but it makes sense. Yeah.
It's a perspective thing for sure. Like you can draw a thing and then you have to invert and reverse.
Distort.
Yeah, to make it a reflection. So, yeah, but she basically says this is a very Japanese characteristic, I guess you would say, like working really hard on what I love is the most fun to me, which like.
I think that makes sense, though.
Right? I think it's kind of like a good thing, but it's also like, oh, working really hard on sales is what's fun to me. She's also kind of saying that, right? Which I think is a very kind of Japanese, like, you know, put your all into everything, like.
I think this one in particular is her saying the manga part is fun.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
She likes doing it. But I don't know if she likes doing sales.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but she definitely like puts her all into sales because she's the top salesperson. Oh, for sure. So I will say, here's my biggest issue with chapter one. This is the girl who they're going to be a romance pair. This is his mom. And they look they look exactly the same. This is not like just same face. Like this is the same girl like this. So I don't know.
Why is his mom blushing like that? It's like it's too similar. You're right.
I mean, it is literally like, yes, it is same face. And she has a slightly different hairstyle. But like, this is the same. Like, this is the same girl. Like this is, you could just, the author is only drawing one girl so far. So, not a huge deal, but
just 50 chapters and it's going to be a Han and Leia situation where they're just,
oh God. Yeah. Or it's just, this is modern day Oedipus, right?
Sorry, Luke and Leia. How did I say? Yeah. Modern day Oedipus. Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah. It would be really funny if the whole series was like, oh, it's actually just a modern day retelling of Oedipus with manga drawing office workers. that would be more interesting than what this was, maybe. Cause that I would be interested in that.
That would be spicy, I will say. Yeah.
Yeah. But I really like this part where he's sort of like considering and thinking about it. I think the art, the paneling and storytelling here is just really good. He's like, I chose work over art. He says, I know this is fine. He's like, and yet he tries to throw the art away. He goes back, and picks it up. He's like, how come I can't throw away the stupid scrap of paper? Like, I can't get rid of the art inside me because it's the thing that I really love. And he calls her. He's like, if you're okay with my art, then I'd be happy to help.
This dude is jacked.
Yeah. He's,
by the way, he's large built man. Like a house.
Yeah.
Am I supposed to notice that? Am I supposed to notice
I don't know. I noticed that too, even like early on, like where, like he, less here, but there was one here. He's just like, the man lives large. He's a built dude. But yeah, I just really like the visual storytelling here of like a kid sitting in front of the thing and then like a scattered desk full of work things. And then he like clears his desks off again and the broken paintbrush becomes a pencil. Like this visual storytelling, this is great. I like this a lot.
You know what? I appreciate the need for compromise in regards to pursuing art as a hobby while still working, because that's the reality. That's the reality of life for a lot of folks. It's not unilaterally pursuing one thing, but is indulging in the things you actually love in your spare time.
Yeah. And this is like, we were kind of talking about this before we started the podcast, but I can bring it up here. Like something that that has been fulfilling to me over the past 2 years of doing this podcast is like rediscovering a love for just like doing something that isn't like work or having my brain distracted by a video game, like producing, making something, recording these videos, recording these podcasts, talking about art, being invested in storytelling. That to me has been my reforming of the mechanical pencil here, of like kind of rediscovering the art and the things that I liked. Like you mentioned, you wanted to be a paleontologist. The thing that I wanted to be when I was growing up was I wanted to be a movie director. Like that was the thing that I thought I wanted to do. I wanted to be the guy who, you know, created and made the story. And this is a far cry from that. But I think being able to talk about stories and talk about how they're created really tickles that same itch for me. So yeah, when I was like a 6, 7, 8-year-old, I wanted to direct movies. I wanted to be Steven Spielberg. I wanted to be George Lucas. Those guys were my superstars growing up. So.
And we were the artist and author behind Tenmaku Cinema, and you guys didn't support that. So
yeah, we tried. Tenmaku Cinema. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, shame on you. I also like this. I like the man became a boy again. This is like the story about like discovering part of your inner child. It's very nice. It's very uplifting. is a very compelling type of thing. And she's like, hey, can you come over to my place? All the equipment's here too. He's like, oh, sure. And this is the end of the chapter. So I'm guessing chapter two is going to be a little bit more romance hijinks. So I'm looking forward to see how they actually handle the romance side of this. Because this chapter one was mostly about the kind of rediscovering art and connecting over that. So
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you know what? Take your time on the romance stuff. I'm here for like the discussions about pursuing like old passions. That's cool to me.
And I will give them that these two do not in any way fall instantly in love in this chapter one. I think we're both assuming this is a romance series. I think it maybe tells us on page one, but there's not really any romance in chapter one. Like they aren't into each other. They aren't like, oh, she's so pretty, and she isn't like, oh wow, he's such a hunk. Like she's found an embarrassing situation. They're both kind of embarrassed that they both draw. They're going to help each other out. There's not really any romance in chapter one. So I think that's a good start, in my opinion.
Yeah, the only love is the love for art. And I think that's a cool thing. I appreciate it.
Yeah, very cool. Anything else on Monochrome Days?
No, it was pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good. Not perfect, but good. Same face.
It's like, your standard fluffy romance.
Yeah, standard fluffy romance, I thought, with a... for me, very personally relatable core from the main character. So I think that's good.
Yeah.
Cool. Just a little bit of news then we can get into. Really just two things. Paru Itagaki, that's the author of Beastars and recently ended Sanda, starting a new series. I want you to listen to this synopsis for me. The synopsis is, the story follows a 33-year-old housewife who has strong spiritual sensitivity. One night, while having sex with her husband, a ghost suddenly appears in her room. She feels humiliated instead of terrified after the ghost witnesses her boring sex life with her husband. The ghost begins appearing in the bedroom nightly.
To do what?
Yeah. This is literally like a... I think this is touted as like...
I'm interested. That sounds funny. Is this like a autobiography?
This is like an adult... comedy, romance. I don't know exactly what it's classified as, but this is like the promotional images that she's drawn for this is like a scantily clad woman in like, you know, a nightgown negligee type thing with like a dead guy whose head is upside down. Also, so it's
that sounds up her alley. I mean,
yeah, this like I might be more into this than Sanda. I'm really curious. I think it started. I don't know if we have a translation of it here in the West, but we'll see. Paru Itagaki is
she's great.
Is a fetish creationist, I will say. Beastars is, that has to be the most furry coded manga ever made, right? Like I
guess
I can't think of anything
like so
else
good. It's
yeah.
like
I'm, well yeah I'm, but I'm, yeah yeah for sure
I'm not furry coded at all, right? So yes. And I love Beastars. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I need to go and read it because I liked what I read of it, but I didn't get all the way. There was a there's a panel that people have been linking talking about this new series she's doing that is, I think, a panel from Beastars where it says something about like, oh God, it's something about kinks. Hold on. I'm going to find it because it's so funny. This is...
I read her like little biography manga. I forgot exactly what
it's
called.
Here it is. It's this panel right here. It's like, your fetishes are what make you who you are. Which is the... it's the... yeah. So... She drew that. I don't think that's swapped. I think that's a real line from Beastars, but maybe not. I don't know. Get in the comments if it's not. Tell me what the real line is.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
So she has this manga called Paru's Graffiti. You can find it on Manga Dex. But it's basically like a biography of her life and growing up with her family, including her dad, who is also a mangaka. But it's just like an insight into how her brain works, and she's a very odd person.
She's very strange. Like, yeah, I think her dad is
very funny, very funny person, and I appreciate that she could just put the weirdest shit out on the market.
Yeah,
and it does well. Keep giving me the new stuff, man. It's better than like high school romance or exorcist mangas.
Yeah, Sanda, I was too weird for me, but maybe just didn't. I don't know. Maybe it was just the same amount of weird and wasn't as quality. So I don't know. I'm curious.
Listen, I appreciate that it exists, even if it didn't resonate with me. Right? Yeah. It's like, fair enough. It's new and different. This seems like a thing about like an exhibitionist ghost story where. Is the ghost going to give her sex advice?
I don't. Yeah, that's this could go a lot of ways. It's like the ghost gives her sex advice and improves her relationship with her husband. She leaves her husband for the ghost. That is that. If I had to guess which way Paru Itagaki is going to go, I would say that this this housewife probably leaves her husband for this ghost. That would be my guess. That seems more up her alley, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, it could also be that the ghost is just a pervert. You know, like, who knows?
I don't know. Probably, honestly, we shouldn't even guess because I don't think there's any way to get into the mind of this author.
Yeah, I know. So. The mind of Mencia in that one. I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
We'll see. The last piece of news here, which is a big piece of news, although it is not really directly related to manga. I thought it was interesting to call out here. Toho has bought G-Kids. So G-Kids is a anime distributor in the West, one of the largest ones. And Toho Productions is the owner of Godzilla and lots of other stuff over there. They bought G-Kids. So that we'll see what that means. I don't know enough about the business to tell you exactly what that means. I would hope that this means more, better Toho localization. Maybe that happens faster. I think Japan has lagged behind, but I think since COVID, they have realized pretty quick that the Western markets like their media and really want their media. We've seen even this year that, you know, manga plus, 2 or 3 years ago really only gave us the popular stuff that was on Jump Plus. And this year we get almost every one shot. Basically every new series is translated unless it's something really mature and niche. And even then sometimes we get them. So, I think more and more Japan is realizing that they, from an economic standpoint, there is a lot of money to be made because Japan has a population of what, 120 million. And, you know, the United States is 330, 340. And Europe, English speaking Europe, you know, is maybe more than 300 million. So, yeah.
And I think they finally realized that just like them, we all have like a gaping maw in our souls that require content.
That's true. Yes. I mean, the content machine is constant. We here on this podcast are happy to fill it with manga, at least partially. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, that'd be interesting to see how that happens. Again, I don't know if that directly affects manga very much, but I think that anime and a couple other things you definitely should see coming a little bit more quickly. So,
yeah, that's cool to see.
Cool. All right, let's go to one more thing. Gautam, tell me about Persona 6. I mean, Metaphor ReFantazio.
Yeah, it's great, honestly. It's I think gameplay-wise, this is maybe the best Persona game ever.
Yeah.
No, it just is. But in terms of story, also very surprisingly fun. It is a ranking of kings, basically. Like, it's basically the king instills democracy and says the next king is whoever is the most voted for. And it's also about racism. And you're the most racisted against race. And you're trying to become king, basically. Mm. Despite being like in last place to start with.
True underdog story.
But okay, so here's the thing, right? Like, there are these like side quests in the game. And like, the writing is mostly pretty good, in my opinion. I think it's pretty solid. But there's a few side quests that where this like a guy will be like, "You filthy Elda," which is your race, "you filththy, disgusting Elda. What are you doing here?
Ten pigs for
why me. Are you talking?" No, he's like, "Why are you even fucking talking to me?" It's like, "Well, if you should know, my family's sword is lost in this tomb and stolen by a lich. But you should maybe get a better hero to help you out. That's not a gross Elda." Anyway, you go get it because you're the protagonist and you give it to him.
That's
and
funny.
He's like, "What do you want, you sick freak?" And he's like, "Oh, you got my sword. I'm really sorry about everything I said."
I take back 40 years of indoctrinated racism that I have because you got my sword back.
I have to work on my prejudices, really, man. I did not mean that at all. Like the fastest walk back I've ever seen. It happens a few times. It's just like,
I mean, it's kind of a joke, but like, if you think about the, like, have you ever seen American History X, the movie?
Yeah, great movie.
It's very much like a good solid way, I guess, to help end racism is like introduce someone who is racist to the person that they are racist against and like have them just spend time around each other. Like, yeah. I think it's pretty much proven that that like vastly reduces racism. If like, if someone, you know, doesn't like black people, if they just get to know a black person pretty well,
humanizes the person. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A humanized person for sure. So the game is doing that. Maybe is this American History X ex-persona.
It's a little funny because it's not doing that. It's instead saying, if you do something for racists, they might stop being racist.
Yeah, if you're really nice to racists and do what they ask you to do, they won't hate you.
Yeah, like go find them their family treasure, and they won't be racist anymore. They'll see your worth.
Yeah, man, I really want to play this game. I just like cannot find the time. I think I'm gonna buy a Steam Deck and play this game on it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm I think I'm like 20 something hours in, and
okay, so
I'm,
like a fifth of the way through.
Yeah, honestly, yeah.
How many of the main dungeons have you done? Like two?
I've done two.
Okay, yeah.
I think there are seven.
Everything, yeah. All of the video game podcasts I listen to have been doing this over the last like 2 weeks, and they like the farthest I've heard someone in was like 40 hours or 50 hours, and they're like, I've done three main dungeons. And I was like, oh
yeah,
my God.
Yeah, yeah. It's a long one.
Like insane.
And it is more gameplay than social stuff in this one. It's like,
that's good. I think this fixed everything that I didn't like about Persona 5 from what I've seen, which was like, sometimes you would get done with a dungeon and it would be like, wow, I have to wait 18 days of just like talking to people, going to the city and like doing nothing, like no combat, just talking to people. I think leveling up the social skills is more clear and stuff, right?
Yeah, no, it totally is. It's way less homework. Would love it.
I know I would. It's just I know it's a 100-hour
game. You need to get the time. I know. I get it.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Anything else on Persona 6? I mean, Metaphor ReFantazio?
Nope. That's it.
Cool. I finished reading, listened to the audiobook, actually, of Jason Schreier's new book called Play Nice, The Rise, Fall, and Future of Blizzard Entertainment.
Dude, I really wanted to read this. How is it?
It's really good. I listened to the audiobook, and the audiobook is by Ray Chase, who's like a anime voice actor, basically.
Oh, okay.
He does Noctis, I think, in Final Fantasy 15. He has a bunch of other roles, but it's really good. It's basically like a full history of Blizzard Entertainment. He interviewed like 350 people who used to work there or work tangentially. It's really interesting.
So what's the future? What does he say is the future of it?
I think the future of it is they are never going to be the Rockstar Blizzard that was from like 1995 until 2008 or so, or 2000, maybe 2000. Like the Blizzard that existed that had only made banger games, like the best of the best, like Diablo 2, StarCraft, World of Warcraft, Warcraft 3, yeah. That Blizzard will never come back. They basically the cool thing about the book is it kind of contextualized for me how World of Warcraft was so successful that it just changed Blizzard. Instead of being a game company that would release, you know, a game every 2 years or every 2.5 years, that was a very successful game that would make them, you know, $300 or $400 million or whatever. And they would kind of do it again and coast on the money they made, or maybe release, you know, were you working on two games at once? Instead it became basically this company makes World of Warcraft and it makes them $500 million or more a year. When they release an expansion of World of Warcraft, Blizzard makes $1 billion. Like it just in that year, they just make $1 billion. And so that, and then the Bobby Kotick stuff, it was interesting because a lot of people historically, if you keep up with Blizzard, like just blamed Bobby Kotick for the fall of Blizzard. He's the Activision CEO who like, CEO or CEO, president, I don't know, something like that. It's kind of his fault, but the interesting part about this is basically that, like, it's interesting learning about Bobby and being like, okay, this guy, yes, he is a capitalist piece of shit who only is interested in making money, but he was also like kind of patient with Blizzard and tried to like communicate what he wanted from Blizzard, and they pushed back on giving him what he wanted, even though what he asked for was, sure, he wanted them to make money, but like the crux of it, and you get a lot more details about this, this is a very abbreviated thing, is that like he wanted Blizzard to make the same amount of money every year and make slightly more every year, right? Which is like, you know, line go up and
yeah,
here, right?
Year over year. Yeah.
The problem was Blizzard pushed back on him and basically was like, we're not going to hire more people and make multiple teams to work on multiple things that are coming out, you know, every year, the way Call of Duty and stuff does. They were like, no, we're not doing that. We're going to stick to, you know, player first, design first, whatever. And we're just going to release, you know, a World of Warcraft expansion every 2 years that, you know, So it's interesting hearing how Blizzard kind of both like insulated most of Blizzard from his asks and also just like didn't cooperate with him and didn't do what he asked when like, I think it seems to me totally reasonable for Blizzard to hire, create a second team and put out, you know, and have two teams working on World of Warcraft and putting out an expansion every year. Like that seems like a reasonable thing that Blizzard could have done and they just didn't do it. And if they had done that, Bobby Kotick would have been happy with him. So it's that. And then he's like, people slowly start leaving because of the pressures of making money and designing things around making money and they leave. And then there's less insulation from Bobby Kotick and then Bobby steps in and takes over. And I don't know. It's very, very interesting.
That's strange. It's just like weird that they pay this guy $30 million not to listen to him. You know, it's like, that's a gig, I guess.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like I said, a lot of people came in thinking like, fuck Bobby Kotick. He's the reason Blizzard went from being, you know, the greatest game company ever to being, you know, loot box Overwatch 2 has no content, like that kind of company. Right. And it's like, he is not really the reason that happened. He is the reason that pushed for Blizzard to make more money, but like, internal Blizzard was a mess is basically the other side of it. It's like internal Blizzard could not figure out how to do the things that were asked of them. They just couldn't. And whether that's because of high leadership or mid leadership or institutionalized, whatever, or thinking that they were better than they were because they thought they were rock stars if they worked on WoW because WoW made $1 billion when it released, you know, stuff like that. It's just really interesting to see sort of like, Bobby Kotick was asking for them to make money in a way that maybe a greedier company would have made instead of, you know, an art first company that Blizzard was. Blizzard also just could not figure out how to do that. And that eventually basically meant that Bobby had to step in and take over because they weren't doing what he asked them to do. So, it's super, super interesting. I mean, anyone who grew up on Blizzard games, like I did, like, Warcraft 3 was the first one I played, but I've played almost everything except for like Warcraft 1 and Diablo 1 at this point. They used to be like the game company and now they are not.
Now they're kind of a sham.
I still play WoW. I still like WoW, but Diablo 4 was kind of like, that was a fine game. I played it, beat the story, and that was it. The most interesting anecdote I'll leave with, and then we can get out of here, is Blizzard basically thought that if they released a game, that Blizzard's idea was take other people's games and make the best version of them, right? Like, StarCraft was this, like, Dune 2 game that they just took and made better. Warcraft was this other... Warcraft was the one that was like a copy of this Dune RTS that they were making and they made it better. They took EverQuest and other MMOs and made WoW, which is, you know, the best version of an MMO. The most interesting anecdote for me was when they made Heroes of the Storm, which is where they saw how big League was and they said, oh, why don't we take what League's doing and we'll make the better version of it. And they made it and it like got mediocre reviews and nobody really played it and it failed in like a year or 2 years. That was kind of it's funny to read that chapter in this book because that's kind of the stepping stone where everyone at Blizzard is like, oh, we used to take ideas and make them the best version and everybody loved it. And then we failed to do that. And they have not really recovered from that. They have not really been back to, we take an idea and make the best version of it. Like Diablo 4 was good. I think there's still a lot of people who would rather play Path of Exile and say Path of Exile is better. So they didn't necessarily make the best, you know, grab all the fans of that genre again.
So that's interesting.
It's super cool book. I was just getting the audiobook and listening to it while you run or something. I thought it was really, it was a really good audiobook to listen to. So
I'll have to do that. That sounds cool.
Cool. Yeah. Anything else? Or let's get out of here.
Yeah, let's get out of here.
Cool. Hey, thanks again, everybody, for listening or watching. Don't forget to leave us feedback, comment, upvote, thumbs up, all that jazz. Check out Twitter and Patreon, linked in the description. Thank you for being with us yet again this week. And say goodbye, Gautam.
Oh, yeah. See you next time. Bye.
And don't forget to read more manga.